Good morning. On today's programme, the devastating impact of Israeli airstrikes on Syria and the Nepalese people calling for the reinstatement of a deposed king. But first we go to Zambia. While many countries are assessing the impact of US tariffs, many others who are dependent on international aid are in turmoil over funding cuts. The US provides foreign aid to over 100 countries, including Zambia in southern Africa, where the temporary cuts have already impacted essential health services and jobs. Karen Creed reports from the capital, Lusaka.
Esther Zulu is HIV positive and has been on life-saving treatment, taking antiretroviral drugs since she contracted the virus 4 years ago. She's one of an estimated 1.3 million people living with a HIV infection here in Zambia. Efforts to support patients like Esther and to stop it spreading have been largely supported by the US government over the last 2 decades. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been allocated to support Zambia's HIV response. The reliance on finance from the US was put in the spotlight in January when a 90-day pause on all foreign aid was announced by President Donald Trump. It triggered widespread alarm in many African countries like Zambia that depend hugely on this assistance. While there has since been some assurance that the emergency plan for AIDS, known as PEPFAR, would be continuing, there is still huge worry here about how critical health services will continue, particularly those related to HIV treatment. Already there are reports of the effects being felt, with some services having stopped in the 6 districts of the northern province. The UNFPA's deputy director in Zambia, Anna Hallstrom, said that over 30 drop-in centres that provide HIV treatment have been shut down. She also said there are worries about the reduction in antiretroviral drugs used to treat HIV coming into the country. With the next batch due to arrive, a much smaller amount than usual is expected. The distribution of these essential drugs is also cause for concern because many healthcare and community workers have lost their jobs since the US funding cuts were announced, therefore leading to major issues for getting these drugs to those who need it. In rural areas, community leaders are worried about the potential reversal of progress made and how a reduction in funding could lead to the scaling back of programs addressing HIV prevention. The Health Minister, Dr. Elijah Mushima, has said they're assessing the potential impact of the aid freeze on Zambia's health sector, and he has highlighted the government's commitment to ensuring that essential services remain accessible despite the funding challenges. Zambia's president, Hakainde Hichilema, also addressed the funding freeze in recent weeks and again this week, reiterating that it served as a wake-up call for African nations to reduce reliance on external aid. But many here in Lusaka are asking how this can be done as the country faces massive debt. While the economy is on a path of gradual recovery, it faces several challenges, including inflation and high unemployment. With a population of around 19 million people and a significant proportion being young, Zambia is also one of the fastest growing in Africa. It currently receives approximately $600 million annually in aid from the US. 75% is allocated to the health sector, and a large portion of this supports the country's HIV and AIDS response. This allows for the support of programs focused on the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV and to ensure that babies born to HIV-positive mothers receive necessary treatment. As a result, Zambia has seen a significant decline in new HIV infections among infants. It has also seen a decrease in the HIV prevalence rate among adults from 16% in early 2000 to around 11% in recent years, as well as improved life expectancy among HIV patients. The history of Zambia receiving funding from the US can be traced back to the early years of Zambia's independence in 1964. Since then, it has been provided with financial support through various channels, including aid for development, humanitarian assistance, and support for health programs. Despite Zambia's government's efforts in recent years to mobilise more domestic resources to support health-related programmes, the health system remains heavily donor-dependent. The Zambia Health Strategy estimates that around 40% of the health sector comes from external funding. It costs about $500 million annually to provide HIV testing, prevention, treatment, care and support services in Zambia. The current situation and the uncertainty has exposed the vulnerabilities of Zambia's healthcare system. As well as putting essential services at risk, it's also affecting the job security of many healthcare workers. Some working within the NGO sector fear that as many as 18,000 healthcare jobs that are funded by USAID could be lost as a result. For World Report in Lusaka in Zambia, I'm Karen Creed.
Next we go to Syria, which has accused Israel of trying to destabilise the country after intense airstrikes on military bases this week and a deadly raid on southern Syria. Since the Assad regime was ousted from Syria last year, Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes in what it says are necessary security operations against what it describes as hostile forces. Sally Hayden travelled to southern Syria, from where she sent this report.
Blood shone in the sunlight, deep red where it splattered the rocks in this wide green valley in Daraa, southern Syria, 2 days after Israeli attacks killed at least 6 people here. Beside us was the village of Koya, where memorial events were taking place for the dead. The trail of an Israeli warplane was visible in the sky on the approach to the nearby Syrian village of Shajara, where Wissam, a 41-year-old mother of 6, lay on cushions waiting to undergo surgery to remove shrapnel from her leg. The surgery will cost $2,000, money her family is trying to raise through donations from neighbours. Wissam said around 11 people, children, men and women, were farming in the upper part of the valley by Koya when the Israeli attacks began on March 25th. "We were far away, they just bombed us immediately. We are 3 sister-in-laws that were injured and 1 man," she said. An Israeli military spokesperson said Israeli forces acted to neutralize the threat posed by several terrorists who opened fire at them. "Look at her face from the sun. Look at her hands. She is a farmer," appealed Wissam's mother, Amina Farouk, prayer beads in her hands. "Please make our voice heard. This is a humanitarian case. Israel is really suppressing people here," she said. "They want our land. We want safety and security. They took advantage of the regime falling to gain ground." Last December, in the first days after the fall of Bashar al-Assad's brutal regime, Israel launched close to 500 airstrikes across Syria, saying it wanted to prevent weapons stockpiles and military installations from being used by terrorist elements. Its forces also launched a land invasion, seizing a demilitarized UN-monitored buffer zone in the Golan Heights, then moving beyond it. Last Wednesday, Israel launched a new wave of airstrikes, targeting military capabilities and infrastructure sites in capital city Damascus, Hama and Homs. The new Syrian government called this a violation of international law and Syrian sovereignty and a deliberate attempt to destabilize Syria. While an IDF spokesman also said Israeli forces eliminated several terrorists who opened fire, authorities from the Daraa government said at least 9 civilians were killed following the deepest Israeli incursion yet. Travelling through Syria's south, I heard numerous stories of detentions of Syrian civilians, seizures and confiscations of land and property, regular Israeli patrols and also softer approaches, like the Israeli distribution of food baskets, all in Syrian territory. A spokesperson for the Israeli military said the IDF is operating in Syria in order to protect the residents of the Golan Heights and will continue to act as necessary to defend the State of Israel and its citizens in accordance with international law. They said Israeli forces detain suspects from Syria based on intelligence indications, and those found not to be involved in terrorist activities are released. They do not prevent agricultural work in areas critical for civilians, the spokesperson said, but Israeli forces operate in these areas in accordance with operational needs. The IDF is prepared to stay in Syria for an unlimited amount of time, said Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz during a March 12th visit to Mount Hermon, Syria's highest peak, located 40 kilometers from Damascus. Wissam's brother Bashar said Syrians want the United Nations to step in and protect them. "Here we are in our land," Bashar said. "We didn't go to them. We are not assaulting them. They are coming to us. They are assaulting us." "Israel says always they have to protect their borders," Bashar continued. but they should protect their borders from their country, not come to our country to protect their borders. For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in southern Syria.
Finally, we go to Nepal, which ceased to be a Hindu kingdom in 2008 when it became a secular democracy after a mass rebellion against the monarchy. But 14 elected governments have come and gone in 17 years, and political instability has cost the country dearly. Some Nepalis have now turned to King Gyanendra Shah, the country's last monarch, for redemption. Sajida Momin has this report.
Nepal, tucked away in the mighty Himalayan mountains, is probably the world's youngest republic. But it's on the boil today, with former King Gyanendra Shah, deposed in 2008 by Maoists, busy fighting a no-holds-barred battle to re-enter his Kathmandu palace and sit on the throne once again. His die-hard supporters clashed with the police last week, leaving three dead, including a television journalist covering their violent march towards the parliament building in the national capital. The landlocked Himalayan nation, sandwiched between nuclear powers China and India, still seems to nurse a soft corner for royalty, despite the demise of the 240-years-old monarchy. The erstwhile Hindu kingdom officially became a secular socialist republic 17 years ago, with King Gyanendra living in a private residence in Kathmandu since then as a commoner without any privileges. Elections have been held regularly under the Republican constitution, but the fledgling democracy is tragically cursed by unending political instability. As many as 14 elected governments have come and gone since King Gyanendra was toppled, leaving Nepal in a perpetual state of flux. A procession of prime ministers in and out of office has made Nepali politics a laughingstock in the whole of South Asia. Coalition politics, driven by greed instead of ideology and principles, is proving to be Nepal's undoing, with premiers sworn in one day only to be evicted from office just months or a couple of years later by their ambitious and scheming rivals. Unlimited corruption is another monster bedeviling Nepal. All these glaring inadequacies, which political parties have failed to fix, seem to be motivating at least some Nepalis to reconsider a return to monarchy, prompting King Gyanendra, who is now 77 years old, to throw his royal hat into the ring. His power grab has resulted in the political upheaval characterized by the deadly violence recently unleashed in Kathmandu that the poor and underdeveloped country is currently grappling with. But his prospects are dim, as almost all mainstream political parties which have formed the present government are united to thwart King Gyanendra and cut him down to size. Some political commentators are gleefully recalling his earlier desperate bids to revive the monarchy and predicting that his latest power grab is doomed to fail like all his previous attempts. There is no doubt that political instability, manifested in one short-lived elected government after another since the abolition of the monarchy, is badly hampering economic growth and discouraging foreign investment in one of the world's poorest countries. There is both anger and frustration over the failure of successive governments to lift the country from the depths of poverty it is rapidly sinking into. In this bleak scenario, the revival of a dynastic monarchy clearly offers a glimmer of hope to some Nepalis, and King Gyanendra is capitalizing on their sentiments by staking his claim to take the reins of power in his hand. The presence of young men and women in the pro-monarchy rallies is conspicuous and telling. They are thronging the demonstrations not out of nostalgia for royalty, but disillusionment. Their participation is a dead giveaway of the frustration among the youth over the lack of government and private sector jobs, which is compelling millions of educated and uneducated young people to eke out a living in the Gulf and the Southeast Asian region, far away from the country of their birth. The gravity of the current upheaval is evident from the deployment of the army to tackle the pro-monarchy demonstrations and processions across Nepal. Importantly, Prime Minister K.P. Sharma Oli is claiming that India is behind King Gyanendra. According to the Indian Express newspaper, Oli made the claim in a closed-door meeting of the core committee of the ruling Communist Party of Nepal. Moreover, he has threatened to provide evidence to back his allegations. The charge is not surprising, as China and India have big stakes in Nepal, and the current Prime Minister is known to be anti-India and heavily pro-China. Oli has also threatened to arrest King Gyanendra and impose financial penalties on him to meet the cost of repairing government buildings damaged by his supporters. But what is most worrisome and alarming is Oli's threat to unleash his Communist Party cadre to tackle the pro-monarchy forces flexing their muscle. If Oli keeps his ominous word, more bloodshed and mayhem are on the cards. For World Report, I'm Sajitha Momin in India.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.